Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the India Independent Films Podcast, where we talk about films and film writing. I am Pankaj. I write on my blog dichotomyofirony and also contribute to articles on the IF website. I have with me again Rahul Desai, critic for the Film Companion and writer for many other publications. We had a large podcast, I think, 5 weeks ago. We typically try to do it every 3 to 4 weeks, but because of some travels we had and some scheduling issues, we are having it today. So before I begin, Rahul, the usual topics, how have the last few weeks been? And what's your memorable one? I know you watched Kohra.
Yeah, I watched Kohra last week, which was nice because it was the first thing I watched after my travels. And yeah, it's definitely one of the better Indian shows I've seen recently. And it's been a good year for like sort of Indian long-form storytelling, at least Hindi long-form story. So there have been some, all the good Hindi titles that you hear of in the last 6 months have all been web shows. And it's good, it's a good sort of direction to head in, because I think it needs more skill and it demonstrates a larger sort of, a larger aptitude towards storytelling when you make shows like this. So Kohra, obviously, we know it's made by, it's sort of co-created by Sudeep Sharma, who also made Patal Lok. And also, it always had big names behind it. Very happy to see that it got good reception, critically at least. I'm curious to see how many people actually watch the show, because it's not very easy to watch. It's one of the slow-burning shows. Apart from that, I watched the Kajol show when I came back last week also, The Trial, which was very bad. I have nothing more to say other than that. It's a remake of The Good Wife for people who aren't aware. Yeah, before that, I was traveling. I was on a trip. I was traveling alone through a few Balkan countries. It was a trip I had planned with a friend of mine who passed away recently. So I did it alone. So for me, it was a very sort of emotionally exhausting and fulfilling trip. And it was something I needed also, because I was working constantly for the last 3 or 4 months, watching, writing. And sometimes it can get a little toxic if you don't acknowledge the fact that you need a break, or you need to grieve, or you need to feel something. So for me, that trip was that. I came back feeling like, you know, I have in me the strength to watch more and fall in love with movies a little more and writing a little more. So it's always nice when travels tend to do that, because it doesn't often happen. And it wasn't a trip I had planned for the middle of the year. I never travel in July. But I felt like I needed to do it this time. I normally travel in September, October, my annual thing. But I just put it in. I didn't care about how much I'm missing. Normally, I'm always worried, am I missing big films? Can I take time off? But this time, I just went for it. I just booked it 1 month before I left. And, and I'm back now. So, and it was a fairly, it was a fairly hectic trip. I went to a lot of places. So I'm glad I did that. So now I'm in a sort of mental space to talk about films, talk about what's coming, because July and August are massive months. There are such big titles around the corner that it makes me nervous.
Right. Did you get to see Djokovic? Did you travel to Serbia?
Yeah, I went to Serbia. So the initial plan, when we had made the schedule in detail before the pandemic, 2020 basically, we were supposed to travel in May or June. We had booked our tickets, booked all everything, and then the pandemic hit, so we had to keep postponing it. So I had vouchers left, so I did it eventually on my own. We were still planning to travel together in June, July, because he had recovered last year before it went bad again this year. So the initial plan was to go to Serbia, because to Belgrade especially, because because of it's the land of Djokovic, also it's the land of tennis. I visited his academy, I visited a few places, but you wouldn't be able to tell when you travel in Belgrade or through Serbia, that it's not like India where cricket is a religion and you see it all around, like hoardings, or you see it all around you, it's consumed basically. There, I don't think, first of all, tennis is an individual sport. And second, I feel like people are very private about their admiration and love for someone like Djokovic, you know. The only sign I got of there being like a proper following of Djokovic in his own country is, I think I took a lot of overnight buses to different countries from there. And in the middle of the night, you have to often get off for border checks at 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. when you're crossing a border. From the bus, you have to get off, cross the border, and the bus takes you. So sometimes when we stop for these toilet breaks or something, I used to go to a local sort of supermarket or a bar, and everyone was very religiously watching the Wimbledon, that Djokovic, at least the Djokovic matches at 2 a.m. their time or 1 a.m. their time, which was nice. These were small Serbian towns. This wasn't Belgrade, a big city or anything. So I got a flavor of, you know, how big tennis is in particular parts of Europe. And same thing happened when I was coming back. I had to stop over in Warsaw in Poland for a day. And I saw that a few people on the streets were a little upset that their world number one in women's tennis, Swiatek, had just lost her Wimbledon match. It was an upset. And I could hear the name Swiatek being uttered on the streets in an alien language to me. So I always travel to get a feel of how sports is perceived in different countries.
Right. Okay. Now, let's talk about Christopher Nolan. As you said, like, you know, July is a big month. Firstly, which one are you watching first, Barbie or Oppenheimer?
So according to professional obligations, Oppenheimer first, which is today evening. Barbie is tomorrow night. So that's how it is. It's just the press screenings are like that. It's not like I have a choice. But if I had to watch it as a viewer on the day itself, I would have gone by the same order. Oppenheimer first and Barbie second.
Okay, got it. And then now, let's talk about Nolan itself. Is he an auteur? Do you believe in directors being auteur theory?
I don't know if I believe in the auteur theory after, like, in this century at least. You know, it's because storytelling has reached a stage where everything that's being done now has been, various versions of it have been done before. Auteur to me, also, whatever it means by the dictionary, I don't care, but it also means a certain sense of novelty and originality, or changing the course of storytelling in your own way. Having a fiercely individualistic way of filmmaking that nobody else has. So for me, Nolan is the closest to that definition, because he constantly pushes the limits of storytelling in his, and that too without sort of compromising on the scale. He's always, you know, interested in blockbuster filmmaking, in big scale, large scale filmmaking that are also accessible to audiences all over the world. That's why studios love him also, because I think he's the only one who dares to get that balance between narrative ambition and sort of narrative scale. And not a lot of filmmakers have the guts to do that. They'd make indie films with concepts like Nolan's. And I've always maintained that he needs to be admired for that. I know Nolan fanboyism has gotten very toxic over the years, especially with the advent of social media and Twitter and whatnot. And it gets a little tedious, you know, after a while on the internet, following these little pockets of fandoms of various filmmakers. But my love for Nolan has always been very, right from the beginning, I've maintained that when I watch a film by him, I'm always reminded of why I fell in love with the movies to begin with. Because to constantly push the limits of sort of trying to tell a story, whether he succeeds or fails is not the point. The way he plays with time, the way he plays with narrative, the way he plays with science and art in the same narrative, it's not been done before. And he's gotten a bad rap over the years for being stubborn about being a purist, about his IMAX obsessions, about sort of rallying against 3D and digital storytelling, and against OTTs and all. And, you know, all filmmakers have their quirks, and at least Nolan's open about his. And for the kind of stories he makes, you'd have to admit that OTT platforms and, you know, digital techniques will not work. He is a kid who, he is an overgrown kid who's sort of grown up admiring film and the biggest sort of scale possible. And I think what he does, the way he sort of stretches what we know about film and storytelling, that too within without really making us feel like he's pushing the limits. I think I always have great deep admiration for him. He is one of my favorite filmmakers of the century. He'll always remain so.
You know, when you spoke about it, I also found this tweet about it's written. Again, I'll read that out. People who dismiss this movie as an Interstellar don't quite understand that Nolan was literally reaching for the stars and beyond in this. If I had to write a film, and I write a lot of random sci-fi shit for myself, it'd be on these lines. If only 10% good, this and Inception. Yes. Have you thought of actually writing films?
So I'm like, amazed actually that considering. But the thing is, back when, back before I was reviewing daily and became a professional sort of film critic, I used to write a lot of short stories just to sort of, with no agenda, with no, I didn't want to get anything published, just to practice my writing, just to feel that, that sensation you feel when you complete a story or when you crack something. And I always maintain that I try to tell stories through my reviews also. And it comes from the fact that I was initially aspiring to be a screenwriter before being a film critic. And I always think in terms of stories. Even as a kid in essays, I used to tell stories. I used to not write formalized essays. So because of that, I ended up writing a few spec scripts on my own just to see how screenwriting works, how the software works, how your mind works. And oddly enough, the first one I wrote was after watching Inception. I was so inspired to write something different that I did end up writing like for a couple of years just for myself, not to sell it around or anything. A script which I held very dear to me, and which when I watched Interstellar, it was quite similar. The philosophy of the script was quite similar to Interstellar. So I always felt very validated that I was on the same track. It was the same experiment with time and storytelling, and with it wasn't so much scientific. There was no space in it, but there was a lot of imagination in it, and the love at the center of that story was very similar to what Nolan did in Interstellar. So I felt like if I had to ever go full speed into a career of storytelling, first of all, I wouldn't be able to do it in this country, at least back in 2013 or 14. I don't know now. And secondly, I'm glad that, you know, I had the same kind of at least narrative ambition as someone like Nolan did. That's how he encourages young storytellers. That's how films encourage the next generation of filmmakers and storytellers to sort of dream beyond, you know, convention, to dream bigger, as he said in Inception as well. And it's very difficult to keep the audiences hooked onto something and to trigger the kind of discourse that he does after every film. Nobody else does that. In popular entertainment, nobody else does that. And I'm amazed that we can call his films popular entertainment. And he does that very purposely. So, I always maintain that if I had to go into sci-fi and actually have a full-time screenwriting career, I'd be very inspired by Nolan's work alone and be aspiring to do his kind of storytelling.
Got it. And that's why I felt, you know, like I've sensed like in your writing space, like even R.T. Kadav's films, you've written good reviews about them, and then The First Man also. So it's actually great to know that you wrote a similar story. That's very interesting. And then let's talk about Interstellar. It's a slightly, you know, polarized. Some people love it, and it's unlike Inception, which was more universally well received. Interstellar divided. What do you think of that film?
I'm a big fan of that film. I think, again, as usual, you know, very few filmmakers have the ability to make you emotional with their craft alone, you know, with their control of craft, all the departments coming together in a scene or in a moment. And two of them are Christopher Nolan and Damien Chazelle recently. You know, he has the ability to make you weep through a scene, through the way he's constructed or crafted a scene, through his sheer control of filmmaking. You get consumed by a scene, no matter whether you like it or not. It's you. Your mind is nowhere else. And Nolan did that for most of Interstellar. Again, you know, great ambition, great audacity, using actual science and, you know, theoretical physics to actually craft a space epic that is trying to be authentic to science without really losing its dramatic license. And some of the moments there are all-time classics. And I know he took inspiration from, you know, a lot of classics, space opera and Space Odyssey and a bunch of others that he made his cast and crew watch before filming. But for me, it stands on its own. Like, it's like, as far as a sci-fi, a big scale sci-fi film is concerned, I don't think you can do any better than Interstellar. Because if you want to reduce the scale and if you want to make something more human, then Arrival is the greatest sci-fi film ever made. And I still maintain that, you know, it's for me, it's, there's nothing better than that. But Interstellar puts into play so many things. The father-daughter story at the center is, for me, I think it's very well done. It's very emotional. Sort of a daughter getting older than a father, just the prospect of that through science alone is fascinating. And I think the only problem with that film, which a lot of people caught on to and said, you know, this is why we don't like it, is because of the exposition. Because there's so much to explain. There's so much to keep the audience on the same page. And there's so many complex theories that Nolan has to put through, has to convey without seeming clunky about it, that he didn't often succeed in those scenes, you know, where Anne Hathaway's character is talking about love, or whether any of the protagonists were talking about the theories, the sort of black hole and the space and the other dimensions. A lot of those theories were very difficult to get across visually, so it had to be the character speaking, and that exposition put a lot of people off. But for me, it wasn't so much of a deal breaker. And Nolan has had a problem with exposition because it's so dense, because all of his concepts are so dense that, and he also doesn't want to lose the audience. So he has to find a more direct way to put it across. And because of that, because his ambition is bleeding into every scene of his and he has to explain what he's doing, sometimes it tends to put you off. Like I thought Tenet was where he crossed the other side, where it was too much for a normal viewer to handle. But I'm sure that if we had actually understood it visually alone, I think it would have been path-breaking. But, you know, it threw the audience off totally. So Interstellar was the beginning of that in that sense, because there was too much to convey, and sometimes it got a little clunky. But again, as I said, that for me, it did not ruin the effect of the film. I caught onto it, and I watched it a couple of times at the biggest screen possible, and for me, the same scenes really made, like, it really made me emotional that a filmmaker can move you like this, you know, with his audition, with his ambition, which is audacity, with his, with just his ability to craft something out of nothing. And as far as space movies go, and as you, you know, rightly mentioned, and I'm a big fan of these movies. So as far as space movies go, I'm very happy Nolan did a space movie.
So you sort of answered my question, but apart from Tenet, sort of any film that you also didn't get, in the sense like you had to read up more about it, what was happening, any film of this?
Only Tenet, honestly. Like Tenet I watched twice, I still don't get it, and I still don't get it. And if you watch it twice and still don't feel it, then it's a problem. And that's where I see where Tenet went sort of slightly wrong. Again, I won't fault him for, you know, for his sort of bravery to make a film like that, to make something so original. To, you know, original IP in this era is very difficult to do, you know, in this franchise era, in this very cash-grabbing sort of, you know, superhero VFX crazy era. And you keep making sequels of classics. Even Tom Cruise is making sequels, no matter how much you admire his action for. So Nolan is the only one who keeps crafting original stuff, and you have to admire him for that. It's not, and the studios love him for that. He's the only one who has the license to do that. So Tenet, you know, it may not have, like, it didn't work for me also still, but and it needs a lot of reading, a lot of familiarity with a lot of things, also a lot of And it needs a very sharp brain in every scene to at least figure out what is happening. The, again, him playing with time and motion. But yeah, apart from Tenet, I think I was always on the same page as far as his films were concerned.
Have you seen Tree of Life? Terrence Malick's Tree of Life?
Yeah.
Did that work for you? Of course, it's not Nolan, but did you like that? Do you remember that?
That absolutely worked for me when I watched it, because I think I watched it at a film festival here in Bombay, and there was a massive line for it. I remember it was one of the biggest, most hyped films in at least cinephile circles here. And I remember going in and absolutely loving the experience of watching the film. Now, I mean, I don't remember much of it now. I only watched it once, but it was a beautiful feeling. And Terrence Malick, you know, I know, you know, he's a very divisive filmmaker in terms of his very stylistic, very individual voice he has as far as crafting sort of slightly abstract, slightly emotionally complex films, and the way he does voiceovers and voices and those lens flare shots and memories. But I love his filmmaking. I'm a big fan of how he manages to push it consistently. And as far as the human mind is concerned, I don't think anyone has done it better, you know, to sort of portray the human mind and the way we think and to romanticize that vision on film the way Terrence Malick does. So Tree of Life for me was right up there, because again, it was a generational, intergenerational story. It was about parents, it was about children, it was about the trauma they inherit and the memories they inherit. So I think it was beautifully made, and a lot of people call it pretentious, but it pushes the limits of what we think is pretentious, what we think is complex, and it intellectually also was very stimulating.
Now, you know, when I was reading about your piece on Nolan, again, you made a very interesting observation comparing him to sort of Imtiaz Ali. This is a piece in Hindu. I couldn't find, because now Hindu has become I just had the first paragraph and I wrote that line, and I'd say like you to elaborate on that. So you mentioned that Ali, Imtiaz Ali and Nolan, where you've written, while one has built a career upon the systematic intellectualization of convention, the other has altered the large-scale cinematic landscape of conventionalizing intellectuality. And Ali's hypnotic hold over a niche existential cross-section of the country's urban millennials is vaguely similar to Nolan's grip over an elite global legion of cerebral junkies. Now, think about it. It's actually true because Ali also, you know, sort of the Tamasha fandom is there. Mm-hmm. But again, first, I'll bring to like the line that you have written. We've spoken about this earlier, that sort of, you know, patterns or like reversing that you'd like to do. Like I find it very beautiful, like systematic intellectualization of convention. And now you've again the second parallel sentence of conventionalizing intellectuality. So this is a great line. So I would recommend people who are listening to find that piece and read whatever you could. But yeah, let's talk about this. If you have any memories of writing this piece and Ali and Nolan.
I mean, I'm glad you read out the line, because I have no memories of writing it now, because obviously back then you forget, and secondly also Imtiaz Ali was a very different filmmaker 5 years ago, right? He hadn't made his terrible films yet, and he hadn't sort of gone off the deep end. So Ali then was still the Tamasha one, the rock star one, the one who always within convention always found new ways to say the same thing, right? That's the whole point of what he did, catering to this urban millennial landscape, which not a lot of filmmakers were doing or getting right for that matter. That's why Ranbir Kapoor worked so well for the existential sort of love stories and for the, you know, the man-child aesthetic. It was very legitimate what he was doing, and that's why Tamasha has become more of a cult film. That's why there's been so much discourse about Imtiaz Ali films before he made Jab Harry Met Sejal. I think if you think about it, at least back then, 5 years ago, I'd say you just conflated to like a higher sort of bigger scale, a global scale. And Nolan was doing pretty much the converse of that in a very strange way, because he was sort of changing our entire perception of how we watch stories, of conventional storytelling, of orthodox tropes, and of a lot of that. So and he obviously catered to a global audience, and none of them forgot that they were making films for viewers. They were making films for people to enjoy in theaters, and I think that was the strength of at least Imtiaz Ali back then, and that remains the strength of Christopher Nolan, that he's not only making films for himself. You know, that's how we tend to think of auteurs, that's how we tend to think of these very distinct voiced filmmakers, that they care a damn about what audiences think. They'll make it for themselves, and audiences will decipher what they want to take away from it. But Nolan has always been very clear that he wants the audience to have a big screen experience. You saw it during his stubbornness to release Tenet during the pandemic. It doesn't always go down well, but I feel like the way he has sort of sucked us into this his world of storytelling through a very conventional scale, which is like this scale we normally associate with Tom Cruise or a lot of other, like Michael Bay sort of scale that we've been growing up on and watching summer blockbusters. He has sucked us in using a conventional scale and then absolutely altered our entire sort of reading of what a film should look like and a film should read like. I don't think there's a better film than Inception in that sort of genre, in that sort of aesthetic. And, you know, I just hope that he continues doing that and people don't, like, just for the heck of being, you know, like, edgy, say that Nolan should do actually a small film, a love story or a rom-com or a indie film or something like that. No, Nolan should continue doing what he's doing, because even within this scale, he's been very versatile. He's made a space film. He's made a period film about, you know, magicians. He's made a sort of sci-fi time travel film. He's made a bunch of them, and it's just he's made a war film, and it's just difficult to reduce him to one kind of genre. And as long as he's doing it on the same scale, it doesn't really matter.
Now, in the three Batman series, which one is your particular favorite, or do you have any favorite, or all three?
I feel like all three work together as one film for me. Like, you know, when I think back, they feel like different phases of the same superhero's life. And I think that's a sign of a good trilogy, right? Like, that's a sign of a very successful superhero. Because a lot of these franchises that we see, and right now that, you know, just keeps expanding horizontally more and more. You don't see one film really intricately linked to the other than plot-wise, right? Only plot-wise, you see a continuation of things. But in Nolan's superhero, in his Batman universe, you feel like it was psychologically connected, all three. They were different phases of Christian Bale's Batman's life, or Bruce Wayne's life. Batman Begins and The Dark Knight was sort of his coming of age as a superhero and his ultimate test as a superhero. And Dark Knight Rises was his twilight as a superhero. So you do feel like when you think of Batman now, or you think of the Dark Knight trilogy now, you feel like you're getting memories from Batman's perspective. You get memories of how he began in the first film, of how he was driven to sort of exile in a way to learn to become a superhero in his own way. You get memories like it's your own life, but it's actually Batman's life. And that's a great thing, because Dark Knight was all momentum, all raw energy, and you know, it was raw conflict, and that's, I think that's what makes it the best superhero trilogy you know, in a while. And it's just I don't think I can sort of say I have a favorite. Of course, watching wise, it was always Dark Knight because of Joker, because in a very sort of conventional superhero manner, it got all the tropes right. It got the greatest villain out there right. It got the biggest conflict out there, right? It got a villain who was just destroying things for the sake of destroying things, not for any agenda. And that's when filmmaking is often at its peak. And I love the fact that, you know, I don't have to compare those films anymore, because I still remember watching all three, I think 5 years apart or 6 years apart, all three came out, 6 years apart maybe.
Yeah.
And I still feel like I watched them within the same week. And because I still watch all of them on the big screen, I still feel like I'm the same person when I was watching all of them. And for a film to fool a person into thinking that they are the same person for 7 years is a great thing for a trilogy to do that. And especially when you look back in hindsight, because you often remember you were a younger person or an older person. But I don't think this trilogy did that to me. I always felt like I'd watched it back to back. And I thought the same in all films, and I had the same relationship with all the films. So yeah, that's pretty much how I feel. Yeah.
Now the other aspect is music, the Hans Zimmer, the soundtrack. Yeah. It's a favorite of a lot of people. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it got me into listening to Hollywood soundtracks without really needing the film. Like, it was the only time I just keep playing on loop Hans Zimmer tracks. Because I'm a big fan of film soundtracks now. I think this was the beginning. Batman Begins was the beginning of me. Batman Begins, and I remember another film, Passion of the Christ, was the beginning of me just listening to soundtracks on loop. Hans Zimmer and Nolan's collaboration has been, obviously, much has been written about. We have read so much about it. I feel like both of them bring out the best in each other, and Hans Zimmer is as much a scriptwriter on his films as anyone else. I have a, you know, special sort of place in my head for background music, because I see such awful background tracks in Hindi films and in Hindi web shows that I always pointed out that, you know, soundtracks, background music and soundtracks aren't supposed to tell the audience what to think. They are supposed to give us an idea of how to feel. And I think Hans Zimmer's tracks have always been an extension of Nolan's action, of the way he frames a scene, the way he stages a scene. It never feels like it's trying to overwhelm the scene or the moment, or trying to tell the viewer, listen, this is how you're supposed to feel. It's just a continuous sort of heartbeat. It's a continuous pulse throughout the film. And it doesn't go into emotions. It doesn't go into it doesn't ebb and flow with the sort of magnitude of what's happening in the film. And I love that the soundtrack has its own language, and it's just there. It's like listening to the air around you right now, listening to a fly buzzing around your ear. It's just there. It's just a constant feeling of tension, constant feeling of dread. Or it goes deep into a character's mind. I'm very keen to see how it is in Oppenheimer, because it's a very different film. It's the closest he's come to making a biopic. And I don't want to call it a biopic till I watch it. So, because I went under the impression that First Man was a biopic, but when I came out, I was like, this is probably the greatest iteration of a biopic that's been ever made. And I hope the same for Oppenheimer also.
How was The Prestige? So, to reframe it, apart from Dark Knight, like this, any other films that really work? Of course, there's a lot of films, but any other films that are your favorite? The Prestige, Dunkirk?
For me, yeah, definitely The Prestige is right up there. Like, other than Inception, other than his, if you take his sci-fi films away, like in that sense, like if you take that entire stretch of Interstellar and Inception and the Dark Knight trilogy away, I think Prestige is his finest accomplishment as a filmmaker, other than those films. Because, and I love Dunkirk, and I really like what he did there. But for me, Prestige was haunting in a way no other film was, especially in terms of that genre. We hadn't seen it before. And I remember watching it like one day and then going back the next day to watch it, because the Nolan twist in the end was very much Shyamalan-esque, but he did it so much better. It was there in plain sight for all of us, and it was of course, and it was very controlled, very good, very very sort of detailed and intricate storytelling. Not easy to keep a viewer in the dark for so many hours, and then unleash a twist that isn't gimmicky. It's just there all along. And I just love the atmosphere of the film, the craft of the film, the period of the film. And I still watch it from time to time. I still watch scenes from time to time just to get an idea of the younger Nolan and how maybe some of the way he used to craft scenes connects to now. But you're not going to get that time back when Nolan made Prestige. Mm-hmm. So I keep savoring it from time to time.
Is there a way of watching films? Like, he's so insistent upon that IMAX and this. Do you foresee, is it rigid or are you okay with any, like, as long as people are watching? Because people even watch TikTok with, you know, so much of, as long as there's a story that connects. But do you have any strong opinions on that?
From a filmmaker's perspective, I can totally understand why he's so rigid about it, why he's so passionate about it. I would never begrudge him that stubbornness, because he has every right to tell us how to watch his film, because he's spent years crafting the film for a precise format. And shooting with IMAX cameras is not easy. We've seen it again and again. So there's no way he would want his films to be watched on any other screen, because I think that's how you started visualizing his films, in through the lens of an IMAX camera, through lens of a 70mm. So, so of course, he has every right to tell us how we should watch it, or how. The thing is, where people get annoyed is because he's like, this is how you should do it. No, he should maybe leave it to, you know, viewers saying, it would be preferable if you do it this way, because this would give you the best experience possible in a cinema hall. And that's how I always, you know, watch films. It depends on my mood. It depends on my how I'm feeling that weekend. If I want to make the commute, the hike, see, it's not always feasible for people to reach IMAX theaters in any part of the world. So for people to reach even theaters sometimes in this season in monsoon in Bombay. Today I'm worried about how I'm going to reach a theater 20 kilometers away because it's been raining so much just for his film. You know, you have to be practical about it, because when you go into the movie, you're transported into a different world. You forget about the world around you, forget about Bombay rains, you forget about how you'll reach home, how you'll write the review. So when that escapism happens within the movie, it's well and fine. But how you get to the movie, how you get back, all of that matters, and whether it's worth it. And with Nolan films, it often is worth it, because he turns it into an event. And we'll do it on our own, you know, like we don't need prompting for that. And that's why tickets are costing like the moon right now on weekends. There are 3 a.m. shows, there are 12 a.m. shows, which is unheard of. Other than Rajinikanth films in this country, I don't think any film plays through the night, shows play through the night. So Nolan's getting what he wants. He doesn't need to be too rigid about it. But again, you know, I think you leave it to the viewer as to how they want to watch it. And whether they have had the best viewing experience or not, or whether they feel like they've lost out on the viewing experience or not. Because I watched Dark Knight in all four. I watched it in IMAX. I watched it in normal theater. I watched it at home. So, you know, it'll only grow that way. So I get where he's coming from. But in the end, we have to be practical here.
Would you ever watch a film on mobile?
See, I wouldn't watch a film for the first time on a mobile, is how I'll put it. I will rewatch a film on a mobile. I do that. When I'm commuting stuck in traffic for 1 hour, I just switch on Netflix and watch something I've already watched. Sometimes when I have to review and I have to take notes from an episode in a web series, I just watch it on my phone. It's easier. I'm not a purist that way. But first time, I'd like to watch it on a bigger screen, either my TV, laptop, or a big screen in a theater. And that's often been the case. That's a personal choice. I don't know how others sort of go about.
I would, you know, first time at least on your laptop. Mobile is too tiny. It's more like, you know, time pass, or again, you have something else to do or write, take notes. But first time always, like personally, I also prefer that. Okay. Now, you know, you are films that, is there grief in them, melancholy? Do you get that feeling? Is there?
I think for me personally, crafted one of the greatest love stories in our generation in Inception. You know, like I know the plot and the narrative and the audacity of the sci-fi sort of takes away from the central love story between Cobb and his wife. But for me, that getting over a broken relationship and grieving the death of a marriage, grieving the death of a family, I don't think it has ever been done like that through your mind alone. And grief is all about what's happening in your head, right? It's not about what you're doing every day. What you're doing every day is you're being a robot and you're going about life, trying to move on and trying to do what people say. But what's happening in your head is memories, and Inception is about memories. Inception is about putting ideas and extracting ideas. That's the exterior. But I feel like Nolan's first thought must have been a love story about how people get over. And that's why Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind is such a great film, because the scale is so small that it's so clear about how you grieve the death of a relationship, how you grieve the death of love, how you grieve a breakup. And I feel like Nolan's heart is always, I feel like he's still a sort of very terse romantic in that sense. He covers it up with many layers of storytelling, but at the core of most of his films is a very very raw beating heart. And at least in Inception and Interstellar, I saw that. The father-daughter story was very moving in Interstellar. Inception, I think, whenever I think of love stories in this generation, I always think of Cobb and his wife and the decay of their relationship, and how she keeps intruding his work life, so to say, his professional life. Whenever he's about to do something, she turns up. That's a metaphor for how grief works. Grief comes in the smallest of moments when you least expect it. I can be laughing tomorrow, right now, with someone I love and having the best time, but suddenly a memory will pop into my head and I want to cry, and suddenly my eyes will be wet. And that's how grief works, and that's how Inception did it, but it did it literally, and that's why people maybe didn't get it entirely. So I think there is a very strong theme of love and grief and loss in most of his films. And I think he's gotten better with it over time. I think Inception for me was the peak of it, but Interstellar was very good at it. I thought the friendship in Tenet was very, very nice also. The sort of male friendship, the buddy movie that it turned into, the bromance it turned into towards the end was very nice. Even though, you know, obviously the twist is that, you know, they were related in the end. But I always like the fact that that there is a human relationship at the center of his film. And sometimes, obviously, the amount of plotting he does and the amount of inventiveness and imagination he uses around distracts from that heart. But for me, for the viewer, it depends on what kind of viewer you are. If you want to hold on to the heart, how tightly you want to hold on to the soul of that film. And that's why I'll always say that, you know, his films aren't all machines and all smartness and all cleverness and all plotting. It's always driven by something human. And sometimes he succeeds more than he does. Sometimes he doesn't, which is fine. But the intention is always correct.
Any Indian filmmaker who comes a little close to his thinking? No. Anybody?
Not really. To think on that scale is a very cultural thing also. You know, you have to be given the license to think on that scale and to evolve on that scale. I don't think Indian cinema, Hindi cinema at least, is not built like that. It's not catered towards scale, and filmmakers who are given a free rein over scale. I'm sure Rajamouli can have different opinions, and he only maybe thinks in terms of scale. But again, his are very centered, very rooted, very Indian films, you know, sometimes problematic, sometimes not. But the imagination is driven by very core Indian values. I don't think in terms of scale, you can compare any big scale filmmaker to any big scale filmmaker. But in terms of narrative ambition, I don't think anyone comes close to Nolan in terms of experimenting, in terms of thinking of a world that's beyond your own, and in terms of exploring the humanity of every world. No, I don't think anybody comes close here.
Okay, I think we spoke about Nolan. Now let's move to another filmmaker, but more Indian, Hansel Mehta. He's a very, like, very interesting filmmaker in the sense, like, his series are so good, and some of his films have been a little hit or miss, largely. What do you think of his streaming era? Like, how has he flowered there? Any general opinion of that?
Yeah, I think streaming, first of all, is one of the best things to have happened to many filmmakers and actors. And Hansel Mehta is also a very good example, because he was already making some very good films before the streaming era, like Aligarh and a couple of others. And he was already, but the problem was people weren't watching them. They were playing in festivals or they were known amongst cinephiles, amongst the industry. The good thing that streaming has done is made him mainstream and in a good way. And, you know, he's taken to it like a fish in water. Like, I'm so glad that he's getting to make the kind of films and stories, or getting to tell the kind of stories he wants to, and enjoying the success that, you know, he might have needed to enjoy some time back. And I guess because Hindi cinema did not give him enough, I feel like, but it did let him hone his craft. His second innings is great, just like a lot of his other colleagues like Anubhav Sinha and like others. But nobody has taken to long-form storytelling like Hansal has immediately. And I'm glad for Scam, and I'm glad for what he's doing after that for Scoop and now the next Scam. It's necessary, you know, to have filmmakers like him is very necessary. He's opinionated. He is strong, expressive politically. He is socially aware, because he's lived a fair amount of life. He has enjoyed a lot of success, but he has also gone through more failure before that. And it's only a cocktail of success and failure that can make you think on the terms that he does now, the way make him as prolific and hungry as he is now. Because I don't think there's anyone more prolific than him right now. He's making series after series. There's a film like Paras that just comes in between. And all of it, you can see that it's very solid, the craft. You can see him evolving with every film. Some of them may work, some of them may not, sure. But you know, I think I'm a great admirer of how he's turned things around and how hungry he continues to be. You feel like he's trying to make up for lost time, and rightly so, because he wasn't given his dues for the longest time. He had to work within a very limited industry. He had to work with maybe collaborators he might not have wanted to. But now you see him, you know, flower into a kind of storyteller that the streaming era is perfect for. And I am very much looking forward to anything he makes in the streaming landscape. And for that matter, even if he chooses to make a mainstream film or something, I'm sure he will never, quote-unquote, sell out. Because, you know, it's just that he's gone through, I think, his fair amount of struggles. He's seen the industry. He's seen it go up and down. And I think he knows now where his niche lies. So yeah, I respect that very much. And even though Scoop isn't my favorite series of the year, I think it's a very solidly made series, and I think it'll be right up there by the end of the year.
I know you have done a separate podcast on Scoop. How was Harman Baweja?
Quite a surprise, right? Like, I think a lot of people... one of his great strengths of Hansal Mehta is the casting, right? We saw that in Scam. We're seeing that in Scoop. Yeah. We'll probably keep seeing that. And it's just, see, because he himself has, as a filmmaker, gone through so much failure, gone through so much struggle, and then he has been given a second chance himself. I think he sees that hunger. He sees that lack of opportunity in a lot of older, in a lot of actors as well. Whether they failed in their time, whether they were pigeonholed by mainstream cinema, whether they were, you know, nepotism babies, whether they were just given limited opportunities on TV or as side characters in films, I think he recognizes that. And I think even Anurag Kashyap recognized that when he came in, and that's why he changed the face of casting. So Hansal Mehta is furthering that revolution. And and Harman Baweja is a classic example of that. We saw many in Scam as well. A lot of very familiar faces we've been seeing in Hindi cinema, just relegated to the sidelines, and or in TV for that matter, and in Scoop as well. Like in Scoop, even Deven Bhojani for that matter, you know, Karish Vatana's uncle in Scoop, who's been a Gujarati stage presence for the longest time, he was there, and Jojita Bohi Sikandar as one of Amir's friends. He's been always on the sidelines. Here he gets his moments to shine in Scoop. He gets his moments. He is the fulcrum of the family attitude towards the journalist who's imprisoned. So, of course, Harman is, you know, hats off to Hansal for being able to direct him in a way that takes away and to sort of pulls on our perception of Harman Baweja, the one we saw, and the one that he's willing to portray now. You know, without any vanity, without any aspiration of stardom or mainstream cinema, just a new person we see now, just a very regular person. And Hansal Mehta has the knack of doing that. And I'm very glad that he views actors and stars and cast the way he went through life himself. And that's why you see a lot of second chances, a lot of people grabbing that with both hands. Even Karishma Tanna, even though I'm not a fan of her performance in Scoop, I think, you know, it's a massive responsibility to shoulder an entire show like that. And I think in terms of that, she still did a decent job. The show did not tank because of her or anything. But it's not easy because she's been for the longest time in TV. I think she was in Big Boss. I don't know. But I've not been following her career. But to just being picked out of the wilderness to sort of run something so cinematic is a brave decision. And only Hansal can do that.
The reason, you know, I asked like Harman Babija, like when I was reading his interviews, he comes across as so, not say bitter, but something just broke him when his film came out and the reviews and all. And, you know, he was very harsh on the critics. But, you know, like at the end of the day, I just was feeling like, of course, it's bad things. Anybody says bad things about me, I'll feel bad. But it's not personal. But I think, you know, some people are very, very sensitive. Of course, like even I'm sensitive, but I was just, I saw that he was so bitter, like when he was giving these Scoop interviews, and thankfully it has worked for him and everybody has praised his performance. Like generally, like it's like, it was a surprise package. Okay, now, apart from Aligarh, I think we've spoken about Aligarh. That's perhaps his best work. Any other films that you have a very fond appreciation for Hansal Mehta's films? Not the shows. Any films that come to your mind apart from Aligarh?
I think Shayad was the beginning of his second coming, right? Like, I think it was a fantastic film. It was also the announcing of sort of Rajkumar Rao as the next big thing. And such a different language of acting and filmmaking in that film, and such a brave film to make. Shahid would be able to be made today in the current landscape with the sort of integrity that Hansal made it with back then. And Shahid was a fantastic film, and I'm glad a lot of people watched it during festivals then. It wasn't widely watched, but I think Shahid is right up there with Aligarh in terms of cinematic impact, in terms of career choices also. And it woke the world up to who Rajkumar Rao is and who Hansal Mehta can be. For me, Aligarh was my favorite film of his. You know, he's had misfires also. He's had Simran, he's had Chalang, I think. But you can't accuse him of not trying different things all the time. And Simran was a massive misfire due to various reasons, collaborators or not, Kangna or not. At least he's gone through everything to come out on the other side a smarter and a wiser and a more skilled storyteller. And as long as you make mistakes like that and then sort of learn from them, it's fine. You can see the arc. You can see the evolution. I would be keen to see that he continues making at least one feature film every few years just to... Because I just saw Faraz, which not a lot of people might have seen, very limited release, based almost entirely in Bangladesh, technically, even though it was shot here. But such a strange film out of the blue to come from Hansal Mehta, but such a compelling film, such good craft, such skill. Even though it speaks about a very specific incident in a country's history, it connects to all other countries' histories. It speaks about, you know, good Muslim, bad Muslim. It speaks about our attitude towards terrorism. And it reminded me of Nirja in a way, the film, a lot of parts of that film. And I would like to see these one-off films like Faraz from time to time, because not just so that he can practice his feature storytelling, but also because I feel like he has a lot more to give in terms of making a film, not just a show. He will continue making shows, and I think it satisfies him a lot. Films also, I think eventually, I don't know what the film landscape is going to look like a year from now, 2 years from now, but Hansal Mehta needs to be part of that landscape.
And he made this trilogy, sort of trilogy again, Omerta and then City Lights with Raj Kumar, all three. Was did you like Omerta? Did you remember that?
Yeah, I have mixed feelings towards Omerta. I thought Rajkumar was pretty good in that. But I wouldn't count it as one of Hansal's greater films or anything. But it was still, I still remember parts of the films. I still haunted by some parts of that film. But again, I feel like Hansal was going into a phase where, again, not a lot of, he seemed aware that not a lot of people were watching his films. And he was making the kind of films that not as accessible, which is not a bad thing. I support filmmakers who are indulgent to ourselves and whatever that term is. I don't believe in that term. I like that Hansal was still making the kind of topics or exploring the kind of topics he wanted to. But Omerta was a strange film to consume in that sense, even though it was a well-made film. It was a sort of strange film to make at that point of time. City Lights, I didn't mind. It was a little more manipulative. It felt like Hansal was trying to get a little mainstream and commercial there. But it still worked for me back then. I remember giving it a favorable review. Maybe if I watch it again, it may not have aged well, but I still had a good reaction to that film. I don't think he's made a terrible film as such. I'm not counting his, you know, his first few films in the 2000s. But I think he's still a very, I hope he remains prolific and he doesn't get disillusioned or bitter. Like a lot of filmmakers with his ideology might get a little tired of, you know, sort of dodging the censor, sort of the censoring of creative voice in this country right now happening. And I hope he doesn't get too tired of it or doesn't get too bitter about it and continues sort of making the kind of stories and being subtle about his opinions. And that's a good thing. And he's overly passionate on, I've noticed once in a while him on social media, and he's very, sometimes a little unreasonable towards critics and towards how they react to his films or to his shows for that matter. But it comes with the profession, you know. Filmmakers aren't expected to be rational about criticism, and it's fair. He's human like everyone else. He's sort of gone through enough. So to be petty about certain things, you're granted the freedom to do that. And it's not everyone is expected to react gracefully to critics. I just hope he doesn't ever cross the line or get as bitter and petty as some of his, you know, ex-collaborators like Apoorva Asrani and all, because they've gone off the deep end. We've seen them on social media sort of just accusing the whole world of everything. I just hope Hansal Mehta maintains that equilibrium and that balance and remains positive and doesn't get into a toxic mind space. It's very easy to do so if you're too much on social media. And Hansal is quite active on social media. So let's see how it goes.
Whenever I think of Hansal Mehta, the first film always used to come to my mind was Dil Pe Masle Yaar.
Oh, yeah.
So, of course, now it's more Aligarh and all. And, you know, I was looking at his filmography. I have not seen Woodstock, Villa, Raak. These were not, his, like, no, it felt like, as you said, they don't seem like Hansal Mehta films now, if you think of them. But somehow, Dil Pe Patle Yaar was always my thing. And you answered my question, like, I was asking, has he ever made a terrible film? But I'll ask another question. How was Modern Love Mumbai, his segment of the grandmother
one? Hansal Mehta one, right?
Yeah.
I mean, for me, it was, you know, probably my second favorite of that anthology, because I think Vishal Bhadwaj was my favorite. Hansal Mehta, it did get a few mixed reviews. I wasn't expecting. I thought everyone would like it, but I quite liked it. Again, it talked about something very relevant. People returning to Bombay, having sort of trauma of the riots. Brave thing to talk about. Wasn't perfect. Had some awkward love sequences, had the queerness at the center of that film was a little strange, acting-wise, performance-wise. It did not feel entirely natural, but it was a short film, and in terms of the impact it tried to have, I think it was fairly successful. It wasn't the most well-performed film, it wasn't the most well-written film, but I think it was still something I'll remember. It was still something necessary. It was it talked about a very forgotten aspect of Bombay, a thing that people don't acknowledge enough, which is returning home or escaping from home and trying to come to terms with your own past and then trying to sort of conflate it with your own present. It's not easy to do. And I think it was a good story to tell, even though he may not have been entirely successful in doing that.
Okay, I think we've spoken for an hour. My last question for today was related to, I had more for Satya, but the film Satya, but I'll ask one last question. You wrote a piece on the film, The Best Scenes. So I would recommend people to read that too if you want to know more about Rahul's views on Satya. But you started with a paragraph on the, you know, the ground zero Hindi films. Satya is for gangster, Dil Chahta is for friendship. Do you have any other ground zero films for romance specifically or any other genre, Hindi, that we should watch?
In terms of ground zero films, which to elaborate on is when sort of it triggers an entire new genre and language of storytelling. I think Satya Farah gangster films obviously inspired an entire generation, like Kashyap's and this, and so many copycats over the years. Dil Chahta, in terms of an urban aesthetic, in terms of not just friendships or relationships, but just the multiplex look that we have today in so many rom-coms and YRF that it thrives on or Dharma thrives on, it came from Dil Chahta. I feel like as far as, I don't know if there are enough genres that we even make that that sort of have enough ground zero choices. I don't know if you can think of any, because I don't know, because in terms of love stories, we can go back to the 70s also, you know, it's just no end to it there. But in terms of sort of NRI love stories, I'd say DDLJ is still like sort of the first mover in terms of how, in terms of globalizing this sort of young Indian romance, in terms of not just keeping it to India, in terms of taking it abroad, in terms of aspirations, in terms of westernization of our values. And I don't think there are like many ground zero films in that sense, because it's such a difficult thing to do. And you know, I think like Sriram Raghavan constantly pushes the envelope in terms of nostalgia storytelling. And I think that's a legitimate genre, because Vasan Bala is also doing the same thing now. Yeah. And I think a lot of Sriram Raghavan films, the noirs that he made in the 2000s, were very steadily had his impact, whether it, you know, Ek Haseena Thi, it very steadily had their impact on how a generation of filmmakers would make these nostalgia heavy love for Bollywood homage films. And his isn't gimmicky, but I'd call him a ground zero sort of storyteller, because making things like Andhadhun and even Ek Haseena Thi back then, and experimenting so much with this language is not easy to do. And I know ground zero means originality, but in terms of even homages, in terms of derivative storytelling, I don't think anyone makes a cocktail of originality like Sriram Raghavan does. Other than that, I can't think of any specific titles that change the face of Hindi cinema per se.
Yeah. I mean, if I have to answer, I'll also start talking about my favorite films, which is not necessarily like ground zero. So it was sort of like, not to put you on a spot or anything, but it's just, you know, I had more questions. So maybe I'll think about it and we'll start with this topic next time. And actually, we'll talk about Ram Gopal Varma. Like, where has he gone wrong? So that we can continue with Satya and like some of his other films, like Rangeela. Yeah, of course, that would be like, you know, genre defining, or again, won't call it ground zero, but something very different for that time. Okay. All right. Again, very nice talking to you. I especially loved hearing about your views on Nolan, on the grief aspect, which is, again, I would remember this topic specifically. So thank you, everybody, for listening. And again, thanks, Rahul. We'll be back soon.
Thank you. We'll be back soon. Okay.